Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In economics, there's more than numbers and equations. It's about making the world a better place.
Economics teaches us about the world and helps us understand the way that people take decisions and, crucially, the way that policy can help people make better choices.
Meet Rachel Griffith and other women who are asking the questions that matter with Women in Economics, a UBS program in partnership with CEPR, the Center for Economic Policy Research. Visit ubs.com/WIE and join the conversation.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 30th of July, these are our main stories. More than 50 people have been killed in gang violence in a Brazilian prison. The main opposition movement in Sudan has called for nationwide demonstrations after four school children were shot dead. The teenagers had been protesting against the shortage of food and fuel. The top UN lawyer in Iraq has called for the public prosecution of Islamic State leaders, similar to the Nuremberg trials of prominent Nazis after the Second World War. Also in this podcast,
this massive survey drew on hundreds of thousands of images of tigers taken by hidden cameras and then analysed by computer.
A new census suggests that India has nearly 3,000 wild tigers, more than twice the number a decade ago. At least 52 people have been killed in a prison riot in Brazil. Local media say gang members from one wing invaded another section of Altamira Jail in Pará State. Officials say rival gangs fought each other for 5 hours and 16 of the dead were decapitated. Others died from smoke inhalation after parts of the prison were set on fire. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Daniel Galas, told me more.
It all seemed like a rebellion at first, that all inmates were together, you know, trying to better the conditions that they live in. But then it clearly emerged that this was actually just a smokescreen for what was happening. A fight between these two rival gangs. One of them managed during the rebellion to walk into the other part of the prison and kill a lot of their rivals. It's quite common in Brazil to have factions in prisons. A lot of these factions control organized crime from inside prison. So this is a turf war between two criminal gangs that actually want to have control of what's happening outside prison, organized crime, drug trafficking, and so on.
And you say it's common to have factions, and this killing, shocking as it sounds, is far from being the only such killing in Brazil's notoriously overcrowded prison system.
Yes, Brazil has the third largest prison population in the world. It's just behind China and the United States. And this is a growing population. Just a few years ago, Russia had a bigger population, but Brazil overtook Russia. And all these prisons are overcrowded. They have about twice as many prisoners as they should have. Back in May, not far from this prison, there was another massacre, similar conditions, where 55 inmates were killed back then. So the second very large-scale massacre in a prison in Brazil in just a matter of months, which shows just how bad the situation is for these inmates.
Daniel Galas in Sao Paulo. The opposition in Sudan has called for nationwide demonstrations after four school children were shot dead. The teenagers had been protesting about food and fuel shortages in the city of El Obeid when security forces opened fire. There have also been renewed demands for a return to civilian rule. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, explained what had happened.
There are images on social media that show quite large crowds of teenagers, mostly teenagers, boys and girls, in their school uniforms, marching through or walking through the streets of El Obeid, which is the capital of North Kordofan State. Then you can hear some of the gunfire, and in some of the pictures also show a student being carried away. Blood can be seen on his legs. There's also an image of a white student's shirt covered in blood being held up on a pole. Now, when the news then emerged that at least four students were killed, we believe five protesters in total were shot dead, that has triggered a great deal of anger, and several other protests have sprung up around the country.
And this comes at a time when there are already heightened tensions between the military and pro-democracy campaigners who are trying to negotiate a transition government.
A lot of tension, and also a severe lack of any trust, especially when it comes to how the opposition protest movement leaders feel about the military. I remember at the beginning of June there was a terrible massacre with dozens of people killed. This will only heighten the tension and probably undermine the negotiations that are supposed to be happening within hours to try and finalise an agreement that will move the country forward. And now we've got the Sudanese Professionals Association, one of the main protest movements, saying that the only way out now is the immediate return to civilian rule.
Will Ross. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Washington plans to start withdrawing troops from Afghanistan before next year's presidential election. Mr. Pompeo said President Trump has given him clear instructions to start scaling down operations.
That's my directive from the President of the United States. He's been unambiguous. End the endless wars. Draw down, reduce. It won't just be us. Those of you who have served know that Resolute Support has countries from all across Europe and around the world. We hope that overall the need for combat forces in the region is reduced.
Meanwhile, the NATO mission in Afghanistan has reported that two U.S. service members were killed in the country on Monday. The police in the southern province of Kandahar said they were shot by an Afghan soldier. The head of a UN team investigating the Islamic State group's crimes in Iraq has called for trials like those held for Nazi leaders at Nuremberg after World War II. Karim Khan said this would make it possible to debunk the ideology that drove the IS phenomenon.
Iraq and humanity requires its Nuremberg moment. Really, what was remarkable about Nuremberg was the evidence. The evidence was collected in a way that could broker no dissent. It would stand the test of time.
Mr. Khan said that it would help to educate communities around the world that might be vulnerable to the lies and propaganda that the jihadists espoused. Almost every day, alleged members of IS are put on trial in Iraqi courts, but human rights activists have heavily criticised these proceedings, saying they often rely on confessions made under duress. So, could there really be such a trial for IS crimes, like the one that opened in November 1945 in the German city of Nuremberg? It was the first time in history that a tribunal had been set up to prosecute war crimes, as stated by the presiding judge at the time.
The trial, which is now about to begin, is unique in the history of the jurisprudence of the world. And it is of supreme importance to millions of people all over the globe.
The chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials was the American Benjamin Ferenc. He's the last remaining Nuremberg lawyer alive at the age of 99. On the line to Florida, my colleague Julian Marshall asked him whether it was indeed possible to find any parallels between Nazi ideology and that of the Islamic State, and whether IS trials in Iraq could debunk such ideology as the Nuremberg trials had done in the case of the Nazis.
No, I don't think any comparisons of that kind are justified, because they bring with them all of the prejudices pro and against. Every case has got to stand on its own merits. And of course, the Nazis committed massive crimes, and massive crimes are being committed in other parts of the world today as we speak. And I think the tradition of taking disputes like this before an impartial court is worth following, and that's what the International Criminal Court is trying to do.
But the crimes committed by Islamic State are so horrific that there are those who say that they bear comparison with what the Nazis did during the Second World War.
I think I should clarify, crimes are not committed by states. Crimes are committed by people, and the people should be held to account, who are the leaders who are directing the crimes being committed in the name of states.
I mean, when you set out to prosecute Nazi leaders after the Second World War at Nuremberg. Did you have a double intention, i.e. that you wanted to see justice done, but you wanted to expose the ideology that drove Nazism?
Well, of course we wanted to expose that what they were doing was criminal. And the purpose of trying to do that was to lay down a rule of law for the future as well, so that any others who might be inclined to commit the type of atrocities which were so outrageous by the Nazi government and the individuals who were committing the crimes, that they become a principal focus, and they should remain a principal focus. We shouldn't get lost in condemning organizations, but look to the people who are responsible and hold them to account in a court of law.
But you must have hoped at Nuremberg, by exposing the crimes and the ideologies of Nazism, that they wouldn't be repeated. But alas, alas, that has proved not to be the case.
Well, of course we hoped it wouldn't be repeated. You know, never again became the slogan. But nations are not yet ready. They haven't apparently suffered enough. They're going to wait for the next it'll be a cyberspace attack to kill half the people on the planet before they wake up. And, of course, I've spent all of my life, and I'm now in my 100th year, trying to prevent that, to stop that from happening. And any movement in that direction meets with my approval, and that's why I'm talking to the BBC now, and appealing to them to not support any government which believes in the rule of force, but to warn them that the individuals who are responsible for the illegal use of force, which means it's not in self-defense or approved by the Security Council, those who are the individuals who are responsible will have to answer to the public and be penalized for their illegal action.
Benjamin Ferencz, the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials that opened in November 1945. The Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been discharged from hospital and sent back to prison despite concerns that he may have been poisoned. He was rushed to a Moscow hospital on Sunday with facial swelling and a rash in what the authorities said was a suspected allergic reaction. But one of his doctors, Anastasia Vasilieva, said the symptoms were more consistent with chemical poisoning. I asked our correspondent Olga Ivshina what was known about Mr. Navalny's medical condition.
It depends which point of view you adapt, because there are two pro-Kremlin voices. They tell, and they use the words of the doctors of the hospital where Alexei was kept. They say, you know, his condition is fine, nothing serious, mild allergy, he was provided treatment, he has more or less recovered, that's the reason he's back to the prison cell. Supporters of Alexei Navalny point out the fact that the head of that hospital is actually an active member of pro-governmental United Russia Party, and they doubt everything what that doctors tell. Moreover, Navalny's personal doctor managed to get in, and she harshly disagrees with many things that official doctors said. She's really worried about his health. She says she doesn't believe it's a usual allergy because, you know, all his body was covered, and she's especially worried by the decision that he was put back to prison cell so soon. So if he gets that back again, you know, he can be exposed to that thing again, and then the reaction can be way harsher and way worse for him. And she says he can even develop anaphylactic shock, which is, in the worst case scenario, can result in death.
And why is the Kremlin so intent on excluding opposition candidates from September's local elections in Moscow? Is this because they're worried about the growing unpopularity of President Putin and his party?
Talking about Moscow, you know, Moscow mayor doesn't have such high approval ratings, and many, many Moscovites are unhappy about what's going on in the city. Last time when Navalny ran for the office, for example, he got 30% of the votes in the first round, despite the fact, you know, he had troubles in accessing to official media, there were some other obstacles. Despite all that, he got his 30%. So this time, you know, there is no official comment on that, but our sources close to the Kremlin told us that, yes, they really didn't like the fact that, you know, those opposition figures could be registered, because then they had significant chances to win.
Olga Ivshina. A former Boeing engineer has told the BBC that work on the production line of the 737 MAX was not adequately funded. The aircraft is currently grounded after two crashes which killed 346 people. The 737 MAX is Boeing's fastest-selling plane and has earned the company billions of dollars in sales. Boeing denies the claims and says it's committed to making the 737 MAX one of the safest aircraft ever to fly. Richard Bilton reports.
The 737 MAX has been a commercial triumph. 5,000 have been ordered, and those sales helped create a bonanza for shareholders. The chief executive, Dennis Muhlenberg, also pocketed more than $70 million. Economist William Lazenick says Boeing has taken its eye off the ball.
Top management is not really focused on building aircraft. They're focused on making money. If you supercharge the incentives of top executives and tell them that their job is to get the stock price up, they're not going to pay the kind of attention they need to pay to ensuring they produce a safe plane.
And the MAX was not a safe plane. Two brand new aircraft crashed shortly after takeoff, first in Indonesia and then in Ethiopia. 346 people died. Dennis Mulana was one of the stewards on board the Indonesian flight. His sister, Resiana, is still coming to terms with the loss.
I miss him all the time. He always hugged me and gave me a kiss. Not anymore. I just thought, did he suffer?
The prime suspect in both crashes is Boeing's computer software. A system called MCAS repeatedly forced the aircraft down. Boeing says the pilots didn't follow the correct operating procedures when things went wrong. But the 737 MAX has been grounded for 4 months, and there's still no sign of it being allowed back in the sky. It's the biggest crisis in Boeing's history. Boeing have spent months working on the grounded 737 MAXs, trying to improve the MCAS system. But the question is, how on earth was this aircraft approved in the first place? Boeing may have been awash with cash, but insiders say they were still under constant pressure to keep costs down on the production line. Adam Dixon led a team of engineers who worked on the MAX.
Certainly what I saw was a lack of sufficient resources to do the job in its entirety. The culture was very cost-centered, incredibly pressurized. Engineers were given targets to get certain amount of cost out of the airplane.
Now even his own family have fears about the plane's safety.
My family won't fly on a 737 MAX. It's frightening to see such a major incident because of a system that didn't function properly or adequately.
Boeing says its former engineer's comments are incorrect and it did not cut corners on the MAX. It says it balances investment and value to shareholders and that it always held true to values of safety, quality and integrity. But 346 people died on Boeing's killer planes.
That report by Richard Bilton. And now here are some furred, feathered and finned creatures that you might be able to learn a thing or two from.
How do geckos walk up walls and across ceilings? How do beetles survive in one of the most arid places in the world? And how do humpback whales power their enormous bodies through the sea? I'm Patrick Ai, and those are some of the questions I've been answering in my podcast, 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter. But the answers are actually just the beginning. The podcast is about biomimicry, solutions to human challenges that have been inspired by nature, like how the gecko's feet might help us grab hold of space debris, how beetles are teaching us better ways to collect water, and how the bumps on humpback whales' fins could make wind turbines more efficient. In every one of our short episodes, we look at a new animal and a new solution. There's lots for you to explore already and plenty more on the way. That's 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service. Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.
South Africa's Cape Town is known as a mecca for tourists, but it's also one of the most dangerous cities in the world. The murder rate has doubled in the last 10 years. There's been an average of 8 a day in the first 6 months of this year. In one July weekend alone, 43 people were killed in the Cape Flats area of the city. The violence has reached such a level that the army has been called in to help police. Just to warn you that this report from Valdi Kerelzi in Cape Town contains content of a violent nature.
This is the base. They shoot a lot here, but then they're quick. They're like cockroaches. They come out, do their thing, and then they're gone.
Jerick Junies is a law enforcement officer with Cape Town's Metropolitan Police. He is on patrol with his partner and more than 30 other officers in a dangerous part of the city.
Okay, you guys go left, now we're going to go right.
Officer Junies grew up on these streets that have become a battleground for rival gangs.
What's your wallet in your phone? Take off, take out your wallet in your phone, please.
These sprawling townships are an apartheid legacy. Guns, even automatic rifles, are easy to come by. It's a lethal combination, and the result is an average of 8 murders a day so far this year, the highest rate in the country. During this operation, officers flood the streets, knocking on doors, demanding entry. So they've just found a gun in one of the houses. The cops saw guys jumping over fences in an attempt to get away. Seems like they've just arrested some of them. They're still looking for 2 more of the guys.
That's a big weapon. That is how they penetrate our bulletproofs.
Is that sort of weapon something you'd normally find?
No, normally you find handguns. But that's a big weapon. I'm also quite shocked. This is my thinking. If I get one gun off the street, I'm saving hundreds of lives. So, one gun. Yo, that's how many cars, how many hijackings, how many murders, how many armed robberies did we now prevent with that big gun.
Hey, that's why you run. You see, I need 2 more.
In a war between gangsters who want to increase their territory to sell their drugs, children are often caught in the crossfire. Mohammed Kiam Peterson was 15 years old when he was shot and killed. His little brother and sister watched as he died. Kneeling at his grave, his mother Shiam fears she won't be able to protect her other children.
The violence has got more and more there, and the children are not safe in that place, truly. They're not even safe in the park. They can't even play in the streets there because it's getting worse there, so...
Mohammed was killed in a shack along with 4 other men in an area called Blikkiesdorp in June. 3 gunmen burst in on the men where they sat smoking. Mohammed wasn't the target. They'd come for a drug dealer called Method Ndege, a.k.a. Toddy.
And you actually heard the gunshots from your house?
I heard that it was going like wood banging against each other.
Aisha Mohammed admits her boyfriend Toddy was selling drugs, but says she's shocked at how he was killed.
They shot him in the face
in the
7
head,
times.
Yes, only here, no other place but in the face only. No other place, just there only. And everyone else was shot in the head.
Just a few weeks later, a similar mass murder happened. 6 women, 2 were cousins, the others all friends, were shot and killed in their home. Police say the motive for these murders is still unknown, but their families are preparing for their funerals. Painting over bullet marks in the wall, covering up the blood.
Now you can imagine that so many little girls were in the room. We have about 6 of us. They shoot one. I'm sure you're panicking to death because you must think of an escape, but you can't.
Because when you look at this, there's nowhere to go.
There's nowhere to go, and these guys are serious.
Out of fear the killers could come back, they've asked us not to use their names.
How many bullet holes were around here?
Only 3, but the others were on their bodies. The other thing, they were all shot in the head, not the bodies.
The army's now been deployed to an area in Cape Town known as the Cape Flats. More than 1,000 soldiers to reinforce local police who are thin on the ground and struggling to cope.
Thank you.
There are roadblocks and stop and search operations happening every day. But still, the killings continue.
That report by Valdi Karelsi in South Africa. A child in Germany has died after he and his mother were deliberately pushed into the path of the train, according to witnesses. Police in Frankfurt have arrested a 40-year-old Eritrean man on suspicion of murder. The mother of the 8-year-old boy was taken to hospital. Jenny Hill reports from Berlin.
Traumatised commuters and tourists have told the police that the boy and his mother were standing on Platform 7 when a man pushed them both onto the tracks in front of the high-speed train. The mother was able to scramble out of harm's way, but her 8-year-old son was run over and killed. Their assailant tried to run away, but was restrained by passers-by and later arrested. It's now emerged that he tried and failed to push a third person in front of the same train. Detectives are still waiting to interview the boy's mother, who's received emergency treatment in hospital, although the extent of her injuries hasn't been made public. Investigators, who don't believe the victims were known to the suspect, are trying to establish why they were targeted.
Jenny Hill in Germany. And now?
Don't go to Paris. Don't go to LA. Don't go to Tokyo. Live there. When you Airbnb, you have your own home. Read a book.
A video advertisement for the online accommodation booking service Airbnb. In a decade, it's become hugely popular with travellers as an alternative to hotels. In major cities, hosts who rent out their homes can earn tens of thousands of dollars a month. But now a London local authority has cracked down on illegal letting in the British capital, imposing a hefty fine of more than $100,000 on one man and kicking him out of his home. Valerie Sanderson has the story.
For 6 years, Tony Harmon advertised his home on Airbnb as a cozy studio apartment in the central London area of Victoria. The property, which had its own hot tub, garnered more than 300 online reviews and was administered by a host called Lara, a fake identity created by the 37-year-old. There was one big problem. It was a council flat owned by Westminster as part of their supply of social housing for those in need, and subletting such apartments is illegal. Tony Harmon was caught after anti-fraud software found his name in reviews and connected the listing to him. A trawl of his bank statements showed he'd been receiving payments for years, and after a court case and a failed appeal, he was evicted from the flat and ordered to pay back around $125,000. The leader of Westminster Council, Nicky Aiken, told the BBC why this kind of case poses such a problem.
If landlords are using short-term lets like this, they're taking away really needed properties. Rents are going up in London because of the proliferation of Airbnb.
Other cities across the world have moved to crack down on illicit letting on Airbnb. In Paris, a tenant who sublet her flat was ordered to pay around $52,000 back to her landlady. And Berlin, San Francisco and Amsterdam have also come up with ways to deal with the issue. Airbnb says it regularly reminds hosts to check and follow local rules, including on subsidised housing. And the company insists it takes action on issues brought to its attention.
Valerie Sanderson. The Ethiopian authorities say volunteers across the country have planted millions of trees in a day to combat climate change and desertification. Droughts are becoming more common in the country. And according to the UN, over the last century, Ethiopia's forest coverage has fallen from around 35% to just over 4%. Luke Jones spoke to the BBC's Kalkiran Yibeltal, who's in Addis Ababa, and heard more about the preparations leading up to this huge planting initiative.
The government has been campaigning towards this day for weeks now. There have been these promotional videos being shown on state media, on social media as well, and they've been urging people and calling people to come together and plant trees. And the government, they were also preparing lands, digging holes as well for the seedlings. And what they're saying now is they have put up a system to not only to plant those trees, but also to monitor that they're actually planted. So the number is pretty huge.
Yes.
But they're also campaigning towards the figure of 4 billion seedlings by the end of this campaign in a few months' time.
And why is there such a hard drive to plant so many trees?
Yes, Ethiopia is one of these countries that have been hard hit by deforestation, essentially. It's a country that has experienced the recurrence of droughts. And if you see some of the figures, they're pretty dismal. And according to the UN, by the early 20th century, some 35% of the total land of the country was covered by forest. That number dramatically reduced to not more than 4% by the 2000s.
Kalkidan Yibeltel in Ethiopia. Now, some good news for tigers in a country that's struggling to protect its wildlife. A new census suggests that India has nearly 3,000 wild tigers. That would mean the population has more than doubled in just over a decade. Jill McGivering reports.
This massive survey drew on hundreds of thousands of images of tigers taken by hidden cameras and then analysed by computer. They suggest a rapid increase in the tiger population, up by more than 30% since the last survey 4 years earlier. Responding to the news, India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, said it was possible to strike a balance between development and conservation. India had about 40,000 tigers when it became independent, but numbers fell to an all-time low 13 years ago, raising concerns about their survival in the wild.
Jill McGivering. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.